the last lecture we have. So it's 1 hour, I think. How long is it? Is it 1 hour? Yeah, so we get to where we get. The idea was here to discuss a little bit more on something more related to RQI, which is based on this protocol that we saw last, which is quantum energy teleportation. And to do that, we have to revisit a tiny bit the discussion we had about the measurement problem in QFT. And in particular, a solution, or a way to go in the measurement problem in QFT. If you remember from that lecture, we talked about it, about things that I would actually like to have in a measurement theory, right? Which is the ability to produce definite values. An experimentalist can write things down, right? It needs to give me what happens after the measurement. I need to have compatibility between successive experiments. I need an update rule. I need to be consistent with the theory, which in the case of QFT, I need to be consistent with the theory. The theory is relativistic, needs to be relativistic. And of course, it has to connect with experiments. Those numbers couldn't be anything. It's like, well, I measure this surface operator in space-time. No, but how do you measure it? No, it has to connect with things that you can actually observe. Now, we discussed that idealized measurements don't work at all, cannot be made work, even in principle, in QFT, extra problems from the usual measurement theory. Now, I wanted to talk a bit about particle detectors. This a way that's going to be coming for this protocol. So what are particle detectors? So how do we, can we have a measurement theory for QFT? And then I can ask you to think, okay, how do you measure QFT really? You do it all the time, right? We're measuring the electromagnetic field all the time with our eyes, no? At the LHC, they measure other fields. In the end, they don't. They just measure electromagnetic fields, right? After all, the sensors eventually as a measurement of the electromagnetic field through couplings and processes that they have under control. So in the end, this is a discussion that is related to a notion that I like to call relativistic cuts. This notion is that at some point, our measurements are going to be made with something for which a non-relativistic approximation is a good one. Our eyes or something like that. We have a quantum field, we make a measurement. In the end, we're going to have at some point, there's going to be a level in which a relativistic approximation is good to describe the apparatus I'm making the measurement. Does that make sense to you? Again, that for some reason, this is sometimes misunderstood. I'm not saying that they are not relativistic fundamentally. Of course they are. What I mean is that to a really good degree of approximation, I can treat those systems as non-relativistic and I'm not making a mistake. For example, imagine an atom coupled to the electromagnetic field, right? And you use the transition levels of the atom to make a measurement of the electromagnetic field. Well, the atom, of course, again, excitations of a quantum field, a complicated one at that. We don't know how to describe it. But a non-relativistic description may suffice for that. Does that make sense? Okay. So I'm quoting Andrew here. When Andrew is asked about particles, what are particles? You remember that my pet peeve with particles and photons and things. Andrew says particles are what particle detectors detect, which is kind of the approach that we have here. Here's one of the simplest models of particle detectors. This is called an Andrew DeWitt detector. And here I give you, okay, this is not covariant as written, right? I would have to give you the Hamiltonian density and be compelling that you can actually have a Hamiltonian description for it. So there's a foliation of space-time, in which I can have a direction of time clearly identified. And I am able to actually define an interaction Hamiltonian even between the system that is detector and field. Those things are non-trivial. I just point you to papers where those things are discussed. That's part of my research lines, right? Writing rigorously or trying to write as rigorously as possible the coupling of something non-relativistic to a quantum field. And what does that mean? And how does that affect everything of the theory? But that's basically the model. The model is pretty simple, right? As written here, in a given foliation, Ex, you have the field coupled linearly to some internal degree of freedom of the detector. Then, of course, this is in some area of space-time, right? In some region of space, which is the support of this mirroring function and switching function in this frame. I assume that there is one frame. I'm not going to get into the technicalities of that because I want to get to cooler things. But, of course, this is non-trivial, right? Because if you switch frames, what is switching and when is mirroring cannot be separated. What we assume is that there's some frame in which the mirroring and the switching factor which is in the proper frame of the detector if you want. But what does that mean by that? If the detector is extended, what's the proper frame? This thing can be non-inertial. So you see how there are many complications. We have to talk about Fermi-Walker frames and rigidity of the detectors and internal cohesion forces, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not gonna get into all that here. But as you can tell, in a very naive way, it's just, okay, get an internal degree of freedom that is subject to laws of non-relativistic quantum mechanics and couple it linearly to the field. That makes sense in some region of space. All right. So yeah, that's basically a fancy way of telling you what I just told you with words. That makes sense, everybody? All right. So, question. If I use particle detectors, that is non-relativistic systems coupled. So you know what's the advantage of that? That I can couple an atom or a non-relativistic particle detectors to the field. And then on the atom, I can do measurements. PVMs, for example, maybe. Maybe I have experiments that are really well approximated by PVMs. I can extract classical information and I know update rules for that. That is the advantage. The problem is I cannot have an update rule in QFT directly. If I do it indirectly, if I couple something that is non-relativistic to the field, that detector is going to learn about the field and I can measure the detector. Which is actually how we measure fields all the time. Keep saying. That's how we measure fields. We couple something to the field and we read out that something. Does that make sense? The question is, okay, how about these four things? Does it have them? Like, does this, if I use particle detector models to measure quantum fields, does it have all these things? All right, so I'm gonna give you just a brief summary of it, and if you're interested in that, we could talk more. First of all, reproducing experiments, there's a lengthy body of literature. How come it's not here? Oh, because it's skipped. No, don't skip it. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you can clear my mistake here, but it seems like where you're going is what people do. So in the normal measurement problem in classical or non-relativistic quantum mechanics, sometimes people solve that by couching the problem in terms of different words, like microscopic versus macroscopic systems. It seems like where you're going here is to do the same thing.
It's a parallel.
Well, it seems like you're
going to
do relativistic versus
non-relativistic. Precisely. That's why I talked about relativistic cut. It's very analogous to the Heisenberg cut, where you put it, at some point we have a system, say, in the old, the non-relativistic measurement problem, you assume that at some point, right, you have a system that is really well described by a PVM somehow. The interaction of the system of the measurement apparatus is well described by a PVM. And that's where I place the Heisenberg cut. Something that I can actually measure through PVMs and it's an okay description. Same here. I'm going to a level in which a non-relativistic approximation is okay. I assume the existence of that level.
That doesn't solve the problem fundamentally, though.
Yeah, it's not a fundamental solution, but the question is, what is a fundamental solution? For a fundamental solution, I can tell you what would be a fundamental solution. Solve an interacting QFT and get your detector as an excitation of a vacuum. We know we're not going to be able to do. That's the problem. The problem that we face here is that a fundamental solution does require, I mean, you can do it idealized, people do it. It's something called the Fuster-Verge formalism. Like Chris Fuster at York works a lot on that, and his group and many other collaborators, Ian Jupp as well in Ireland, from the point of view of algebraic QFT, and they do couple, they have two QFTs, right? And they couple in a finite region of space-time, and one is the detector theory, one is the probe theory, right? The problem with that is that it's still a QFT. That is based on the assumption that someone somewhere knows how to measure something about a field, right? So in my opinion, that is really elegant. It's really cool. My statement of limitations for that is that, well, you still have a field theory. How do you extract from the detector field theory? How do you extract the information? You have the same problem. And the second is this modeling anything realistic? Because the only couplings that you can actually solve are extremely simple. A realistic detector is an excitation of a very non-trivially interacting QFT that you don't know how to solve. And in fact, you don't even know if there's a solution that you can write. That's the main issue, right? So the fundamental solution is not this. Indeed, I agree. It's just the fundamental solution may be out of reach. But let's discuss if this gives a measurement theory or not. But first of all, the first thing that you could say is like, oh, maybe that's not really a valid measurement theory because it doesn't satisfy any of the four criteria that you want from it. Does that make sense, everybody? So yeah, this is not a fundamental solution to the measurement problem, but it's perhaps, and We'll talk about it later, the conclusion. My claim is that maybe there's no fundamental solution that we can actually reach. Anyway, reproduction experiments, that's an easy one. Look, this is dipole coupling. This is the coupling electromagnetic fields to a dipole, say an atom, for example, hydrogen atom. That dipole coupling, you can tell it looks well. I'm not going to convince you there's not. It's non-trivial, obviously. There are non-trivial issues. Electromagnetism is like gauge theory to begin with. And how do you identify the observables that are physical and so on? And can you do a scalar approximation, really? Under what circumstances? What does that mean? But that is analyzed in these papers. But you can tell, at least unwavily, right, that this is the electromagnetic coupling, dipole coupling. Looks a lot like the monopole coupling to the scalar field that I have there. It's kind of the monopole analog to the dipole coupling. It does reproduce experiments. People actually use in quantum optics models that are much simpler than that. So people actually do from this to that, and then they do extra approximations on it. They don't care that much about relativistic. So it does, this thing reproduces experiments. That is, I'm going to give you that as a fact of life. It's really good. You can connect it to experiments. That's like one of the advantages that this has. People in quantum optics and atomic physics use these models much more simplified than this. All right, here's maybe the one that may look more difficult. I have slides on all of it. My plan is to skip many and just tell you, and if you don't believe it, I have the slides to show you. But this is the most difficult to reconcile, perhaps, because you have a non-relativistic system that is coupled to a QFT. Are you messing up with causality? Well, there are two issues that you can have when you do that. Violations of general covariance and FTL signaling, in particular. So adding these two things is part of the research line that I'm talking about. I'm going to claim, for example, if your detector is point-like, if your detector non-relativistic system is actually point-like, meaning that it only exists at a point in space in a given foliation, it's fine. There's no problem with it. It's covariant. The coupling doesn't break covariance. And everything is causal. There's a couple papers more coming out of that. But these papers are with, you may know some of those people, because they were PSI fellows 2 years before now. They're now PhD students of mine. Bruno is also co-supervised by Benny. And you will have him as a TA of one of your courses this year. You take it. Anyway, so we can, if the detector is smeared in space, right, kind of makes sense that there's going to be trouble, right? Because you are one single degree of freedom internal of the detector is coupled to space-like separated points, right? But the point is, okay, how bad is it? Is it under control? Do we have a scale that controls that? And can we do, if we do, for example, a perturbative analysis, can we push anything that violates covariance or does any kind of FTL signaling outside of what I'm looking at? Can I look at things that are actually covariant? Can it be subleading? Can it be controlled by scales? This is the kind of analysis. So my claim is, I'm going to make the claim here, and I have slides to justify it, but I'm not going to show you unless you really insist. My claim is that, yes, they are okay with general covariance, and they're okay with signaling. You can use particle detectors and not care about that if you know what you're doing. Of course, you shouldn't abuse it. So basically, there are limits of scales in which you can do it, but those scales are compatible with the scales of energy that you're looking at for your detector. That's the claim. Make sense, everybody? All righty. Now, this is the part that regular QFT is missing. We don't have a way to obtain a classical value out of a measurement, a number, and provide an update rule. And that is this paper here that the process that you would do is like you couple the detector to the field, you make an idealized measurement of the detector. We know, and you know from the tutorial, right, that the update rule that you do on the field is a POVM, right? And that POVM is going to be consistent with relativity based on the previous claims that I just made and you believe. So you can make a measurement theory, and this paper is about that. This paper is making a measurement theory out of particle detectors. And like what happens when you have selective versus non-selective measurements, contextual updates, where the information can travel, all that stuff is done in that if you're interested. So my claim here is that with the particle detectors approach, you can endo QFT with a measurement theory. If you want to not consider the detectors, you can think about the POVMs that come from the detectors. Together with the update rule for POVMs, gives you a measurement theory for QFT. Is that believable? Okay. Good, good. That's all I wanted to tell you. Not trivial to convince people, of course, that this thing is... this published long ago, but that's the archive reference. That particle detectors are okay, because again, non-relativistic coupled to relativistic sounds woo-woo, right? Anyway, so let's talk about space-time engineering, right? I mean, this is a little bit sensationalistic, but the idea here, oh yeah, that's the paper. The idea here is, okay, this is a very RQI-ish philosophy of protocol. Can we use, so imagine I want to design a space-time. I want to have some, you know, metric configuration in space-time. What I have to do, of course, I know, I have to prepare a particular stationary density that through the dynamics of GR is going to give me a metric, right? Now, the point is, can you use tools from quantum information to help you design a space-time? And this is what we're going to talk about. In particular, we're going to use quantum energy teleportation to try to design space-times that are exotic. That makes sense? Space-times. We're going to try to design stress energy densities that violate energy conditions, at least on average. That makes sense? Does everybody know what I'm talking about when I say that? I know you do, or you should. What about everybody else? If I say violate energy conditions, do you know what I mean? Okay, good. Anybody doesn't? Okay, good, good. Yeah, that's nice. All right, so the idea, this is Nico, was a PhD student of mine, also a PSI fellow from long ago. I have a long tradition of PSI fellows that are grad students. This is Nico, right? That's the idea. The idea is that we want to do that. Again, you don't need much here because you already know all that, right? But basically the idea, I have the weak here because it's the easy one to check what it means in interpretation. The weak energy condition basically tells you that nobody, this has to be true for all time-like, it needs to be time. Of future directed time-like vectors either. That means that there's no such thing as negative energy densities for anybody. Yeah. Now, the idea is that if you violate energy conditions, as an example, you violate energy conditions, you can get things like these as solutions for Einstein equations. That are problematic in many ways, but are also interesting. We probably know that these things are not really the way GR predicts. So you want to, you know that, right? Closed time-like curves are inconsistent with quantum theory. You know that, right? Superdeterminism. The idea is that if you have a closed time-like curve, history is superdetermined in the sense that, yeah, typically you can try to go and kill your grandfather, right? But then you shoot your grandfather. Why would you do that? But imagine that you do it. And then the bullet only grazes your grandfather and gives your grandfather the scar that you always remember he had. This kind of thing, right? That, oh, it was there from the beginning. You cannot change history because it would be a paradox, that kind of stuff, you know? That is incompatible with quantum mechanics, indeed. You can have an experiment rigged so that you generate an experiment that turns itself off in a closed time-like curve only out of the measurement of a quantum measurement, right? An unbiased quantum measurement. And if QM is probabilistic in nature, that's incompatible with the existence of closed time-like curves like that. So this is space for finding parts of GR that are not okay, let's say, that are that may be extended in terms of GR. Yeah, question?
I guess I'm just wondering, like, you know, it's true that if you violate the, like, the null energy condition, then you get a lot of weird things in GR. But also in quantum mechanics, you know, I've heard of things like the quantum focusing conjecture, which is like a quantum version of the null energy condition. I thought that like stronger, like quantum focusing conjecture or whatever would sort of prevent the like super exotic stuff. Do you know anything about
that? I know. What I can tell you is that if you violate the weak condition, I can build your warp drive. And there are limits. Of course, you cannot violate. There are bounds on how much you can violate energy conditions. But you can violate the null too. Huh? And there are bounds on how much you can violate them. We can talk about it. There's the quantum interest conjecture in particular, which is what comes out of this. The quantum interest conjecture tells you that you can, but you have to pay a price for it. There's only a maximum that you can. And also you have to generate more energy density around it. That in total is more than, technically, you can leave everything at zero on average, right? When you integrate stationary density, the ground state is zero. You can, in principle, generate negative and positive energy, right? Not quite. You actually need to generate way more positive than you generate negative energy. it's a price to pay for it. But yeah, no, there are, you still can violate, and you do violate energy conditions. But the IQC creates states that violate energy conditions, for example, every day. Squeeze vacuum, for example. A squeeze vacuum state violates energy conditions. Especially if squeeze vacuum goes like, and gets negative.
Right. I just meant, I had thought that the subset of ways you can violate energy conditions that are allowed by like the quantum versions, like the quantum focusing conjecture, still aren't quite general enough to allow for the really weird stuff, I thought.
That's not true. Yeah. I'll show you an example. All right, that makes sense, everybody? All right. It's very easy to find a state. For example, if you want a warp drive, stress energy density, not the metric, of course, the initial condition for the warp drive, you can do it, no problem, with QFT very easy. I can give you a state that has that. Generating wormholes is a little bit tougher, but if you generate two warp drives, you kind of have a wormhole, quote unquote. You don't, but you almost have a wormhole. You have something similar to what a wormhole would do. So yeah, in principle, I know examples. The answer that I'm so confident on that because I know examples of states that are allowed by the dynamics that violate that in ways that allows for those solutions, at least in principle. Because one thing is having the initial condition, and I think it's how gravity would back react to it. All right, makes sense? Anyway, picture of a warp drive. This is the average weak energy condition. This is the quantum energy condition. This is a quantum inequality. Oran Fenning dedicated a lot of time to studying violations of energy conditions in QFT. This gives you about, you can tell, right, that if you have a, you integrate over a region of space-time, basically you have a bound on the violation of the energy condition, and you can violate it only, it depends, for a small, if T0 is very small, you can violate it a lot locally. If you have a big region, you won't be able to violate it a lot. That's the bound. That makes sense? All right. Now, people have published papers, of course. There are many cases where you can do optimal violations of that, like saturate this inequality. One example typically is accelerated mirrors. Accelerated mirrors create states of the field that terminate to speeds that are comparable to the speed of light, typically create energy densities. Negative energy densities as well. Violate the weak energy conditions is very easy with those. People have studied that a lot. It's rather unphysical in the sense that you actually need a mirror. You need to accelerate to relativistic speeds. So I don't know of any mirrors that you can accelerate to a relativistic speed. That makes sense? You can simulate them for sure. People, Chris Wilson at the IQC did what people call the dynamical Casimir effect experiment, which is a simulation really. Very clever. He got a transmission line and superconducting circuits, right, superconducting qubits coupled to it. Depending on, simplifying a lot, depending on magnetic fields going through the superconducting qubit, you can effectively change the boundary condition. So if you can change really fast those magnetic fields, it looks, an effective theory in the line looks like you're changing a boundary condition. So nothing is moving in that case, a simulation with another system, but you do see the dynamical Casimir effect prediction. Yeah, physically speaking, a mirror that accelerates to high speeds, you cannot really do. That makes sense? Let's talk thermodynamics. Okay. So let's talk about something called Stroh-Local passivity. Now, we all know that thermostates are passive, right? You cannot extract energy from a thermostate. Let me define the notion that it's going to be stronger but local. So passivity means that you cannot extract energy from doing unitary operations. Strong passivity means with any kind of operation, not only unitary. Strong local, the word local means the following. So I'm going to touch, yeah. I'm going to do that. Oh, no, not really. Oh, I don't have the hand. Oh, yeah, I do have the hand. All right. So I'm going to touch a system in a thermal state. If you do that, if you just touch it and don't allow enough time, you're actually, in general, not gonna cool it down. Mind that this is very hot, and the hand is very cold. You would imagine, what do you do when you put it in contact? Well, you would expect perhaps that the cold things get hotter and the hot things get colder, right? Well, if you do it really fast, actually, you are inserting energy. That's what happens with the strong local passivity, right? I know, you know why I say it very fast? Because it's only a local operation if you don't allow enough time, right? if you allow enough time, there's the unitary evolution of the system that will involve everybody in the action. Yeah, so it's not local anymore. It needs to be really fast to be local. So if you locally, if you touch a system in a passive state, like a thermal state, you're gonna insert energy in general. You're not gonna extract energy from it, no matter how hot it is. If you touch the sun very fast, you're gonna get colder. Your hand's gonna get colder. That makes sense? Quote unquote colder, of course, not gonna be a thermal state. Now, there's a local passivity basically tells you, okay, if the ground state of a system contains max rank entanglement, you know what that means? It means the composition is all the possible terms, right? It's not maximal entanglement. I mean max rank. It involves the whole Hilbert space. Huh? There's no sector that is entangled. Then there exists a temperature, T star, larger than zero. And then when the temperature is below that T star, it is not possible to extract work from the system through any local CPTP map. So local passivity is not every system, but a generality of systems is the systems whose ground state has max rank entanglement, which is almost anything, by the way. Everything that's coupled, you have a many-body system, even first neighbors coupling, that's enough. You have entanglement then that is max rank, the ground state. That makes sense? All right, so this Masahiro Hota found it first. Sufficient conditions. Here we have the sufficient and necessary conditions for strong local passivity. It's quite strong, right? Because it means that. Is that what I said, right? That you're touching something hot and you get colder, quote unquote. You lose energy to something really hot instead of getting energy from something really hot. The energy flow goes that way. That makes sense? All right, so we saw, at least for a ground state, right? We saw that the protocol of quantum energy teleportation uses as a resource the entanglement of the ground state that we have there and allows for local energy extraction, right? But what are we violating here? Well, the operators are local, but we are adding classical communication. That's what we're adding. Local operation, classical communication. Somebody measures, somebody can send information, I can act on the information. Make sense? All right. We've already seen that. You do a POVM on the first system. You send the classical bit of information or bits of information that you get to be a B that's a unitary that depends on that information that allows for extraction of energy. Make sense? So you break through local passivity through LOCC. Now, we talked about the intuition, right? There are correlations. So measuring A provides information about B. So being clever enough, you can actually push B in the right way. So you get energy out of it. So, cool, we saw a toy model. So what happens when we do it with quantum field? Consider even a free scalar theory. We know that the ground state of that is entangled. Space-like separated regions, the field in space-like separated regions, you can have observables that could violate Bell inequalities. You do have entanglement. You know all that, right? The ground, I mean, this is kind of fundamental in many, in particular, for example, if you get a region of space-time and compute the entanglement of that region with the rest as an area law, a free theory, you know all that, I assume? So can we pull, there is entanglement in fact, quantum energy teleportation was born out of QFT. Then you can adapt it to finite dimensional systems, but it was first seen in QFT. So can we actually do the same? Can we use the entanglement of the ground state to pull this trick and activate zero point or the energy density, let me call it that, activate zero point energy density by measuring somewhere else and use that entanglement. So this is the first from 2008. Masahiro Hota first proposed it. The idea is you have Alice and Bob, there's a scalar field here. Right? Alice and Bob can act on the field. Alice, in fact, acts with detectors, say, on the field, for example. Alice makes some measurements. And the measurement, of course, puts energy. I'm plotting here the energy density. Think of T00. Think that Alice and Bob are co-moving and share a frame, just to make things simpler, right? So Alice puts energy into the field because carrying a measurement has some cost. But let's make it so that Alice only couples to left movers, OK? We can engineer the coupling so it only couples to left movers. Why? Yeah, because I don't want the energy propagate to Bob. If I want to do a clean show that I can get energy out, I don't want it to be contaminated by the energy that Alice put in. Does that make sense? That's why they coupled only to left movers. Or he did. Then Alice sends the information to Bob, and Bob does a local operation. And indeed, what was proven here is that you can actually get energy out. A consequence of that, of course, is that locally the stress energy density is going to go negative because it was on average, of course, because it's going to be, it was zero before. It was the ground state. That makes sense? All right. So this is, let me put it here. So if you actually wanted to, if you want to extract energy, that's all cool. That's nice. And Masahiro has applied to many things, very interesting stuff. You can actually send wave packets of negative energy to black holes and things like that. You can talk about consequences of that. Super interesting stuff in terms of information, quantum information and gravity. But let's focus on the space-time engineering. Imagine that I actually want to create violations of weak energy condition, for example. That's a bit of a problem, right? Because if you want to do it in a way that is quote-unquote realistic, and by realistic, I mean that it moves from sci-fi to a problem of engineering. And that's what I mean by realistic. Problem engineering, maybe not for this century. But by problem engineering, I mean like given the laws of physics don't actually give you a fundamental limitation. That's what I mean, okay? So if you want to do that, you better work with couplings that don't couple only to left movers. It's very easy to couple only to left movers in 1 plus 1D. It's not easy to couple to only left movers or one direction in n dimensions, right? So in fact, if you want to use atoms, atoms do couple to left movers and right movers in all directions, right? Couple to all the k's. Make sense? So look at the difficulty. What one wants here, on the left, the idealized, the hotter case, if you want. On the right, one in which the coupling is isotropic. So that you put the energy there, but the energy starts propagating both to the left and to the right, of course. And the blue ball is the classical information moving from Alice to Bob. The classical information is going to move at the same speed. If it's a massless field, say the worst case scenario, a massless field, right? It travels at the same speed. The energy from Alice to Bob travels at the same speed as information. So we still want to do something that creates negative energies there. So can we? I'm going to discuss a tiny bit that. Be fast. So, all right, so we're going to focus on the state of the field, not on the energy extracted. We're going to focus on, we will look at 3 plus 1, and we're going to use the more concrete protocol. So we're going to use atomic probes, something that models atomic probes, particle detectors that are modeling atomic probes. All right, so the protocol here is, well, Alice measures the field by coupling an atom or an array of atoms, right? Then Alice measures the non-relativistic atom, and Alice broadcasts the result of the measurement to an agency of Bob's that are surrounding Alice. And Bob's agents use that information to prepare atoms, a cloud of atoms, and then release them from Faraday cages. They couple them to the field. Does that make sense? That's what we're going to do. All right, so before doing the 3 plus 1 decays, let's do a toy model. And the toy model is looking at 1 plus 1D. Here's a couple of unruly detectors, very idealized, that couple really fast in time, as you can tell. A delta coupling for the switching. Again, when you compute the time evolution of the coupling, you see that the expectation of the stress energy density has the contribution from detectors of Alice dumping energy into the field. There's a contribution of the detector of Bob dumping energy into the field. Lambda is the smearing function of Alice this detector. Bob is the smearing function of detector. So in this, I'm assuming that it's only one detector, 1 degree of freedom coupled to the whole cloud. We will talk about many detectors later, for simplicity that. And there you get terms that are the ones that are gonna allow for the QET term, right? You can tell that depending on the sign of this expectation, this is going to be positive or negative. Does that make sense? All right, so you do it. Let me just show you a simulation. Again, I don't want to spend the time on that. This is the energy density immediately following Alice's interaction. Okay, notice that the energy density, I have a Lorentzian or a Gaussian switching, is moving here. No, it's a Lorentzian one, or I keep forgetting. This one is probably a Gaussian. this is a prime, this is derivative of the of this mirroring. That's what you have to fix there. So right after you got the Lorentzian, yeah. So right after you got the coupling to the field, you get that. Then the two wave fronts of energy start moving, propagate to the left and right. Okay, that's where Bob is. Bob is at 15, x equals 15. So say that I have Bob here, and then Bob receives the classical information and prepares the atoms, right, and acts with the atoms. And that's what happened immediately following after. It's not that things went down. Look at the axis. Huh? The things went up. Makes sense, right? Bob is also dumping energy into the field, very similar to what Alice did by coupling. So you get twice the energy, kind of, in there. But of course, you need to wait until part of the energy goes left to see what goes right. Okay? So let's do one more time step. So you have a right propagating thing and a left propagating thing, and look at that. You get a violation of the weak energy.
I'm still a little bit puzzled by the whole energy teleportation protocol. Uh-huh. You're saying you're using LSEC, which made sense when we're talking about like entanglement of the resource theory, because you can't create entanglement through classical communication. But under classical communication, you do transfer energy. If I call someone up in California,
arbitrarily low energy, that's the thing, right? I mean, how much energy? Give me an experiment and I'll tell you, okay, use three orders of magnitude less frequency. Or the photon that you use to communicate. See what I mean? It's independent. This is arbitrary. The energy that you spend in the communication can be negligible. Can we always be made way lower than the energy scales involved in the problem?
So you're certain that it's the energy that is transferred through the communication is not this energy that you're
seeing? Certainly not, because the argument, it could be any, I can encode the information in any energy, right? In principle, the cost of encoding the information can be as cheap as you want.
Also just like a single bit that Alice needs to
see. It is. Well, this is a bit more than that in this case. It's a qubit. We will discuss it.
Yeah, right.
It's a small amount of information.
It's like not that much information, so it's...
Well, I guess I was thinking in terms of like the resource theory perspective. Like you want a free operation that does not allow you to transfer anything, the energy in this case, but that's not generally...
A classical communication at low energy is something that we give for free, this resource theory.
At low energy, yeah.
This expected value is just for energy momentum of field, right?
That's right.
But the thing that is really matter is the field plus Bob's hand, right?
The nice thing though is that Bob's hands remain at 15. So if you go far enough, this thing will propagate. So the field perturbation, I agree, everything gravitates, right? But Bob's hand, in fact, the mass of the atoms that he uses is going to dwarf everything that we do here, right? You're not going to have negative energy density. But these things move at the speed of light if it's a massless field, whereas Bob remains stationary. Make sense? All right. So we can zoom in and we see this violation. This is nice, but this is 1 plus 1 D. And you do the same. Oh, by the way, you see, you of course get, this is the quantum energy conjecture going on here. In 1 plus 1 D is not a conjecture, it's a theorem. Something called Flanagan's theorem is really nice about what are the stress intensities that are allowed for the field in terms of how negative they can get in terms of distribution. You always generate more positive energy than you generate negative. The nice thing though is that you have a peak of negative energy density. All right, let's do 3 plus 1. Now, there are several complications. In the first protocol, I didn't really get into the details, but the first protocol, I did is send a qubit. Alice actually does the measurement and sends a qubit, basically the state of the detector. Remind the detector is a qubit, has two levels. Alice sends the detector to Bob, and Bob uses the same detector. 1 plus 1, that's fine. There's only one detector. You can use a photon if you want and teleport the state of photon to another detector. No problem. But that's not true in 3 plus 1 D. You cannot send a qubit. If you have a qubit as a detector, you cannot send a qubit to everybody around in a cloud. And then, I think 3 plus 1 D is more complicated, much more complicated. So the idea, and again, I had the time I would go through, but that's an interesting, you can actually, the idea here is that Bob is going to operate a set of detectors. And the set of detectors is going to be distributed in a shell around Alice to the point that in the continuum limit, you get that the mirroring function is a density function. It tells you how dense your cloud of detectors is. Now, that's not a one single degree of freedom, but one can actually prove, and again, I would refer to the paper for that, one can actually prove that you can substitute quantum communication. It's the one that we use in 1 plus 1D, which is local operations and quantum communication. It can be substituted by, not in all cases, but in particular for the choices of if A0 is an eigenstate of sigma y, you can have the same effect, overall effect on the field by using classical communication, just sending the classical information and acting on every bit. The equivalence is definitely non-trivial, has to be proven, but it can. It's not true always. It's only true for particular states of the detector that you put in for Alice. But what this allows us is to actually prepare, talk about a cloud of detectors for Bob instead of a big detector that lives on a shell around Alice, which is very unfair. Anyway, so same thing as we had before. Let me show you the numbers because this is kind of faith, right? I'm not really proving to you anything. So if you trust me then, so you have, this is Alice's detector. This is near the center. This is the radial coordinate center at Alice. And then you get Bob's cloud of detectors, that is a shell around Alice at some radii, right? As depicted here. This is a cross section. This is a further cross section. Radial cross section. All right, so again, Alice interaction on. Then it propagates. You see that because, of course, you get the ingoing modes and the outgoing modes bouncing back from the center, right? All right, there we go. That's the wave packets that Alice has prepared by interacting with the detector. That's what it did to the energy density of the field. Okay, so now we've reached Bob. Cool. What makes the measurement? That's what's happening there. And then the pulses propagate, one inwards, one outwards. Look at the tiny violation of stress energy density here. And of course, it's going down, right? This thing is propagating outwards. So it's dispersing. So let me just zoom in. You see it? Tiny bit of violation of energy conditions there. Very tiny, but how tiny is it? So we know how tiny it can get. Is it optimal? Can we scale it? Can we control it? So the idea, fine, I defined here this phi e, which is the total amount of negative energy, so the integral over the points in space-time where this thing is negative. You can actually scale the switching function. You see, you have to scale the coupling strength and the smearing in a particular way. But if you scale it like that, so what you do, think of the coupling strength. Think of the coupling strength here as part of the smearing. So it's the density of molecules that you have in there doing the same thing, the density of atoms. And of course, it needs to be less smear, make it more concentrated. The idea is that I can scale, I can make the magnitude bigger, but make it more concentrated in space.
Of space?
This is n-dimensional space, yeah, this scaling law.
That's a small n. What is that number?
N?
Yes.
4. I'm not sure. Yeah. Ah, yeah, sorry, my bad.
One dimension, you cannot do anything, right? You cannot scale.
Well, you can scale sigma. Sigma is under your control. The power law, you don't control. But the thing that it gets powered, you control. Sigma is how much you make. You see that it's not really linear. It's not a... just reducing the concentration, like it's a bit different because the scaling law is different inside and outside. Yeah, you can control it by controlling the density of atoms that you have. Now, again, not going to prove it, but this scaling law is the scaling law that you get when you violate optimally the energy condition. So this allows for optimal violation of energy condition protocol. So you can build states of the field that violate as much as they're allowed to, of course, which is not everything, right? As much as they're the... You can make it as big as you want, as long as it's smaller in space. Huh? Of course, the thing that is missing here is this is not, I mean, do you really get, and that's where all the discussion enters, do you really get weird space times? Well, I don't know. I need to switch on gravity for that. And that is something that is not easy. It's in the work. Not easy because it's, again, gravity, right? Nonlinear equations. And also, you have to control the fluctuations too. I'm feeding Einstein equations with expectation values. What happens with the fluctuations, right? You can use something called passive quantum gravity. Have you ever heard about that? Passive quantum gravity, I think it's a misnomer, but that's what it's called. It's not quantum gravity. Passive quantum gravity is you see, you solve Einstein equations as if T mu nu was a classical variable. And then instead of putting the expectation values at the beginning before solving the equations, you put it at the end. So you have fluctuation. At some point, you're going to get T times T. And when you get T times T and you sandwich, you do expectations there, you're going to get the fluctuations of T coming in. So it's basically a stochastic gravity that is fed by the fluctuations of T mu nu. The fluctuations of T mu nu induce fluctuations as the passive part. Is the fluctuations of T mu nu from the quantum matter that induce fluctuations on space-time structure. We're not putting hats on the Gs. The hats are on the T still. It's just I wait a little bit to put the expectation values, and I treat them as classical variables. It's a summary, of course. That was introduced by Ford as well. Same Ford I mentioned before. Also, Baylock Hu has worked on it a lot and developed it. It's nice. It's nice. It's actually interesting because it allows you to tell, okay, how do quantum fluctuations affect gravity? But it's not a quantum theory for gravity. If you call it passive quantum gravity, it sounds like it's quantum gravity, but it's not. Make sense? All right. I think this is as much as I want to tell you, mainly because I really want to open for discussion for the last 10 minutes, I guess. I wanted a bit more. But at least you saw, there's a tiny bit of seeing one protocol that is directly applicable to things that you knew from QFT, and you can tell the kinds of things that you can manipulate. The idea here is, again, use quantum informational protocols to try to manipulate states of quantum fields in ways that are interesting. Anyway, any questions or topics that we want to discuss? Well, maybe I should have, I tried to leave like half an hour, maybe I should have given 1 minute or so. I can't believe it. You don't have not anything to discuss? You were so active in discussions throughout the course. We didn't have time to think. Go ahead.
But it's not related to the course. How the weak measurement works, what is that actually?
Yeah, weak measurement is a measurement that doesn't give you total information about the system. Imagine, when you think of a POBM, imagine that I'm measuring an observable, and in the end I know that the observable is one, the value is one, with 75% certainty. That doesn't give you full information. So this you can connect, this kind of measurement, so this from the point of view of POBMs, right? This kind of measurement can be connected to a measurement that you do indirectly by coupling something weakly to the system. You're coupling something weakly to the system and the probe get correlated, and then you do a PVM on the probe. The POBM that updates the field is what we call the weak measurement.
What happens to a state update in this measure?
You update like a POBM.
But the changing of density metrics is a small, right?
It's big. If it's weak, if the measurement is weak, the change is small, yeah.
It's kind of making the problem that we had with normal measurement was it was very discrete, right? It was up or down. But this, it means like it's very continuous. It doesn't solve the problem that we have.
It does not, no. Again, the measurement problem is only solved as long as you believe in a Heisenberg cut. At some point,
it's kind of solved the Heisenberg cut. We don't need this continuous type of measurement, right? It's just.
I don't think it does. I don't think it does. So this is a matter of opinion. If you want, you can keep doing continuous measurements, and the state update to be. The continue in the end. The point is that if I obtain the information about the system, I'm modifying the system enough. So the compatibility of successive measurements. You can do small modifications, but in the end, if you get full information about the system, that's going to be equivalent to a predictive measurement.
Yeah, but there is no Heisenberg cut anymore, right?
Because it's a continuum. At some point, you write, okay, in reality, at some point, somebody writes a value, no? So if somebody writes a value, that's where the Heisenberg cut is. Unless your value has uncertainty, then, of course, you don't have the Heisenberg cut, but you also don't have a measurement outcome either. So yeah, no, I think the measurement problem, but it's, I think it is related to the course indeed. It is related. No.
It wasn't about the material you covered, right? You didn't cover it.
Right, right. Well, I did cover POBMs, so in that sense, yeah. But yeah, no, again, and there's also a lot of, because you can do, I didn't talk much about selective, but probably you did in foundations, I assume, selective versus non-selective measurements. Knowing that you measure something versus knowing that you versus something and you know the value of the outcome. That's very different. The states, and again, you're talking with somebody was not very ontic. Eh? So what I'm going to say, it's colored by that. The state, the density matrix that describes your state afterwards has to contain your state of information about the system. because if you do a non-selective measurement, right, I do a non-selective measurement, somebody measure, but I don't know the outcome. Sure, then what I have has to be updated by a probabilistic distribution of obtaining all the values with this probability, right? And that's the state I have. However, if they tell me the result, I need to update it consistently. If you use quantum mechanics with a PVM, according to that result. So that is extremely important in the description of the state. The description of the state has to contain your state of information. So you see, how you obtain the information is not as important as you obtaining the information. If you have the information, you need to update. That's the point. It's kind of difficult to chew, right? Because people don't want to think that because knowing something, the state changed. But I think that is only problematic if you assign status of element of reality to this, which I don't. So I don't care that the state changes with my state of information. You see, taking to the absurd is like, oh, so your state of mind is determining, you know, when people do popular science and stuff, right? Your state of mind is determining the state, and they start doing crazy and people do a lot of bullshit about that outside of science, right? But that's the problem with that comes if you really want to assign reality to the state. If I don't assign reality to the state, why not? The state is just describing my knowledge about the system. Whatever the system is not the state. That makes sense to everybody? How do you feel about that? Are you all agreeing on that? Not everybody agrees.
So let me propose this and see what you think. So I have Alice, who does an experiment, prepares some state, and then Bob and Charlie. And then Alice tells Bob that she just did a measurement but doesn't tell him the result. And Charlie, she also tells the she also tells the outcome of measurement, and then they do the same experiments. They should get the same results, but you're saying they should have different states.
Not quite. So a single shot result could be the same, and it will. If everybody, somebody that has information about the three, so you see, it's the same caveat when people say that, oh, you cannot transmit superluminal information because you need communication in order to actually realize that. In order to check that happened, you need to have information about the three of them. So the person who's checking whether they have the same outcome had to update with a selective measurement, according to what Charlie had. So for that person, the state is always the one that is updated with the measurement.
I guess I'm saying
contextual.
Do this a bunch of times, right? Bob will have some measurement statistics about the experiment. Charlie will have some measurement statistics about their experiment. And if they meet up later, they just compare what they've already done.
Then Bob cannot use the state that he updated. So Bob can only use the non-selective update as long as there's no processing region.
Paper for PRL, right? And then he later reads Charlie's paper and get the same results.
Correct. But Bob would conclude.
States is what you're saying.
That's the thing. But Bob would not have obtained any result. In that case, you have a processing region. The publishing the paper assumes this is Bob, this is Charlie, right? And there's some region here that is causally connected to Bob where there's a processing region in the where everybody reads the paper. In order to predict the outcome of the paper without reading it, meaning like, well, I can know what Charlie did. I know the state that Alice prepared. Remind that somebody tells you, I know what Alice did. I know what Charlie did. I know what Bob did. I can predict the outcome of the paper because of that. To predict that outcome, you need to do the selective update with the Charlie measurement. You know what I mean? Is the fact in this region, the state in this region, if you want, will be the state that is selectively updated by the measurements made. It doesn't make sense to talk about the comparison. The point I would make is here, it doesn't make sense to talk about the comparison. Only people who are causally connected with the processing region can talk about it.
But the paper is saying, is Bob saying, in my reference frame of this region of space-time, I received these results. And Charlie's paper is saying, in this region of space-time, I received these results.
Yep.
But they're receiving identical systems from Alice, and so they should
not quite. Do you believe in so? What is your form of describing a density metric? Imagine when I told you, get a black ball and a white ball in a bag. Get one and don't show me. The density matrix for that ball for you would be a statistical mixture of black and white. The description without looking at it, and then forget quantum. We can talk about the same thing classically. And another person, Charlie, gets the other ball, but Charlie actually measures, right? For Bob, the description of the ball would be 50-50, the probability distribution, black and white. For Charlie, would be 100% black, for example. Now, somebody, if Bob starts doing experiments, he's not going to get, if we assume that in the future, the two experiments are going to be compared, of course, the results of Bob will never be contradictory to the results of Charlie. Even though they have different states, see, the states reflect the state of information, they have the same physical system. You know what I mean? I'm talking that the state is not the reality. That's what we are maybe confabulating here. Bob has a state that is one half white projector plus one half black projector. Charlie has a state that is black projector. Still compatible with each other, different states, because they have different states of knowledge, different information.
But if Bob does a bunch of experiments, like measuring whether the balls are black or white, he's only going to get black balls.
Correct.
Right?
Yep.
In some sense,
if he does that, he's doing a selective measurement. If he gets that information, he has to update with the projector black or white.
An ensemble, right?
Yep.
So he just measures on this box, I measure whether it's black or white. On this
yep.
box, I measure whether it's black or white. And he just happens to get all black balls.
That's right.
Even though his state is one half, one half.
Well, the state is no longer, that's the point. When he measures, he's obtaining information about the system. So he needs to update the state with the information gotten. So the
state. Receiving a new state for, to do measurement on each time, right?
It doesn't matter. Is the state is the row is the information about the ensemble. See what I mean? You have a row of the ensemble. And the moment that you measure, you need to update the state of knowledge that you have. And that's the state. I think the problem comes, the conflict comes when you assign some reality to the state, which I think you're implicitly doing in this.
I probably am.
There's something real that Alice prepares that is a state. That's what you say. Instead of sending a physical system, and then different people have different degrees of information about it. This is what I'm advocating for. I know it's not, I'm not saying this is the, what I say is the right way. It's certainly the right for me. But there's enough people thinking different things about this that is controversial enough to make a debate about it. Yeah. But the state is not something of physical reality. That's my point. The state is reflecting both something about physical reality, but also your state of information. That's why you're allowed to use a density matrix for a single qubit. This is what you get. You might not have an entangled single copy of an entangled state, right? And I trace out the other one. My best description for the half, imagine it's a maximally entangled. It's a maximally mixed state, right?
So are you saying that the like pure states are a function of your knowledge, or the mixed states are a function of your knowledge?
States.
States
are a function of your knowledge. If you have a pure state, it means that you have full knowledge about the state.
Right, but for you, then, there is a real thing called a pure state.
There is something that is a physical system, and having full information about the physical system is akin to knowing the pure state of the system. Yeah. That's what I would say. But I would separate conceptually the state from the physical system. Again, if we don't do that, I would even argue that it's problematic to talk about single-shot experiments again. Because what does it mean to have a density matrix for a single system? Which you do. Imagine. A Bell state, right? And then get this guy and trace out B.
We don't have to get too into it, but I would say it doesn't have to be. It could be a single shot within a single world.
Okay.
Something like that, but we don't have to.
Fair enough. My point is, again, in any case, okay, fine. Maybe you want to think about the pure states of being real in a many worlds kind of way. That's fine with me, you know? I have no quarrel with that. But I would still say that anytime you use density matrices that are not pure, what you are reflecting is your ignorance. And it's important. So it's important to consider that the density operator is actually telling you about the system and the information that you have about the system. It's the only way to do quantum mechanics. Well, I keep saying absolutes. People do disagree with it, okay? So take it with a grain of salt. I really have strong opinions, and that's why I sound so confident. Shouldn't be. There are two different lines of thinking about that. Even if I disagree with the other one, there are really super intelligent people better than me that don't, you know? So one has to take it into account. I do have strong opinions. I would argue that the state is not physical. You can give it physicality like that. In a many-world interpretation, pure states can be thought of as physical like that. Sure. I have no quarrel. Also, it's not falsifiable, so that's why it's interpretation, right?
But in many worlds, could mixed states be thought of as physical? That's
what's that?
But in many worlds, could mixed states be thought of as physical? That's the question.
I wouldn't understand the physicality of mixed states in many worlds. I really wouldn't. Because for me, again, I think of the mixed states as the distributions that have the Shannon entropy associated with ignorance on the state. So I don't know. I wouldn't know how to think about it. For pure states, I have no trouble.
I think the Everettian canonically takes mixed states as being a representation of your state of knowledge.
That would be
justified.
That would be the way.
Like what it subjectively feels like to branch.
That's right, yeah. Also, that's very compatible with the whole wheel or the wheat business, right? In which there's no time, time emerges out of interactions. The universe is pure, but we only have access to a finite amount of information, and that determines your mixtures. And that actually allows the passage of time. We would have no time. If we have full information about the universe, there's no such thing as time. Time is a product of ignorance. That's kind of cool. It's a flow of entropy. Entropy increases. Why? Because ignorance. If we actually had access to the universe wave function, the full knowledge, there would not be any time, right? I like that. Kind of cool to think about it. Again, many people do think that the states are physical. You will hear that often. To be honest, less and less in my environment. I don't know if it's me being biased or it's a thing that is going down now, but ontic versus epistemic, or maybe I shouldn't say it because it's being recorded. Ontic versus epistemic, I haven't heard many ontic voices lately. Maybe I don't ask too much. What does Rob Speckens think about it? You know? Did he say? What's that?
I think he's very epistemic.
He's very nice. You know, I would trust him. I trust him beforehand. I mean, Rob Speckens is the person to go. If you want to ask a very foundational question, PI, Rob Speckens is one of the people to go. Any more questions? You know, there are still people working on, you probably know that, there are people still working on Bohmian mechanics or pilot wave mechanics. That's a thing still. It's fringe, but it's a serious thing. By that, I mean scientists working on it. You have a lecture now?
No.
Okay, cool. There are people that go even beyond that, that they say, no, there's something physical related to the state, but it's not anything that you do with quantum mechanics, not a wave function. There's another step towards that direction. A very looking for something. I think that humans, again, opinion here, humans, we have a tendency of want ontic explanation. Wanting. It's good. It's satisfying somehow. I understand the thing. I think this is our prejudice, that we try to assign physical value to the objects we work with because it makes us feel better. But maybe that's not the way to go. I don't know. I'm not saying that. The nice thing, though, about an epistemic approach is that does physical reality exist? I don't even care, right? Maybe I care about the illusion that I'm experiencing. It's a thing in philosophy. People in philosophy still debate if physical reality is a thing. I'm not kidding you. A serious, serious academic topic. Huh?
We have had conversations about...
Oh, really?
The way to think about science.
If you are a non-tech person, you may have a lot of trouble with that. If you're epistemic, you don't care. You say, okay, cool. Resolve it one day if you want. Anything else? This is a cool topic. It's a really cool topic. I could talk about that all day. What other courses do you have going on now?
Chaos.
What else? That's the one that Bruno's going to be TA of. Oh, no. It's quite Information of Gravity. What's the name of Benny's course?
Information and holography.
Right. Bruno will be at TA. Bruno is amazing. Bruno was also PSI student, same year as Thales. I don't know how much you're in contact with past PSI people. Is that a thing?
Thales, we are.
Yeah, I believe Thales is always here, so. But yeah, Bruno is amazing. No. I mean, Thales too, don't get me wrong. Everybody in my group is amazing. I'm not going to say otherwise. I'm just talking about Bruno in particular because you are being gonna be TA'd by him. So that's good. Very knowledgeable guy.
That'd be good.
I go to him for many questions many times. Bruno, tell me about this. He knows this stuff.
Very nice.
Okay. If that's it, maybe we can leave it. How do you find the course? Did you like it?
Yeah.
It's a bit ambitious to try to do a quantum info course in 1 month. And still touch upon different things because all of them require more. Things may seem either trivial or too complicated depending on what you choose. If you go to get in depth or you want to scratch it, I try to touch many things, have discussion. So hopefully that worked. You still have one more tutorial today. It's going to be mainly short. I may show up for the tutorial if you have questions or anything that I want to discuss. But other than that, I think that's it. I hope that you took something out of the course and good luck for the rest.